The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors.
Welcome to Beyond, an hour-long program of science fiction, fantasy, and adventure. If you enjoy the program, please drop a line to beyond3x5@gmail.com.
Pleased as a Peach by Daniel Rogers. Why is this alien city obsessed with picking the perfect sacrifice? Wouldn't any schmo do? I mean, all he has to do is climb a ladder to the ladder god's abode and die or live happily ever after or whatever happens up there. But no, they have to put on an elaborate tournament to find just the right one. And now Bob is not telling me anything about the next elimination round. I didn't want to get this far in the first place, and now I'm forced to tackle the semifinal without a clue about what to expect. Alora keeps hearing whispers about a mountain, but the details are sketchy, and apparently that's the point. This round tests our faith. Bob, the shaman leading this year's Pick-a-Sacrifice tournament, pulled me aside, looking around, trying not to be seen, and whispered, "The semi-final is outside the temple grounds." My jaw dropped. Had he forgotten about the elite guard waiting for me outside these walls? They'll arrest me before I'm halfway out the gate. I can't. You know what will happen. I'm just going to have to quit the tournament. No, Bob's eyes widened like he had just seen a ghost. You'll be excommunicated. And that's bad? It sounded good to me, anything to get out of this ridiculous tournament. Yes, very bad. I'll have to throw you out. Talk about a rock and a hard place. If I do, the elite guard will arrest me. If I don't, the elite guard will arrest me. So tell me, Bob, what scenario ends with me not getting arrested? I have an idea, but you're not going to like it. He told me, and now my eyes widened like I'd just seen a ghost. The remaining 44 hopefuls lined up for the celebrated March of Faith, a round so difficult that only two will go on to the final. Near the end of the line, Alora and Bob gently tried to coax me into an oversized saddlebag. I didn't really mind the bag so much, but the beast carrying it bothered me very much. I've met one before, and the encounter left me with a small traumatic experience. The tiger-like body with a mane like a lion would make any sane human pause, and the claws and sharp teeth would make any sane race from any planet throughout the entire galaxy pause, except for this planet. They think it's cute and cuddly. "Lemmix wouldn't hurt a fly," Alora said. "Stop being a baby and hop in." "Just because you two are besties doesn't mean he won't eat me when no one is looking." Alora rolled her eyes. "Dignits don't eat meat. They're kind and gentle, and the locals use them like horses. This is no horse. Either get in or face the elite guard." Alora has such an annoying way of being right. I obviously have no choice. The beast looked at me like I had lost my mind as I reached out with both hands in a gesture of peace. Alora helped me get inside the saddlebag and tie it shut. The only thing I remember about the march is the smell of leather, the feel of leather, and the sight of leather. After what felt like an eternity, Alora untied my saddlebag and helped me out. Her saddlebag ride didn't have the same effect on her as it did on me. My back ached, my arms and legs were stiff, and I was grumpy. The march ended on top of a mountain. Not the peak, but definitely high up. Cold winds and thin air welcome us with annoying arms. Bob stood there looking as pleased as a peach. "Good morning. You all have probably noticed by now that you have a companion with you. Now that I think about it, why is Alora with me?" "They are your Sherpas. They will guide you through the challenges ahead. You must do what they say to succeed. The first two who complete the course will be our finalists. May the latter god give you favor." "You knew about this?" I asked Alora. "Bob approached me yesterday. He thought you'd want your sister to be your Sherpa." "My sister?" I said with indignation. "Well, it was either that or your wife." "Sister is good." I took advantage of my navigation pod to map out the quickest route. Alora pulled it out and double-checked. "Wait, let's just hang back and let these idiots try to win. You know I don't want to go through with this." "I do, but you want off this planet, don't you? You need to make up your mind. If you want to stay, then fine, I won't stop you. But if you want to go home, then stop whining and let's get started." "Why is she always right?" "Fine, lead the way." Alora whistled and Lemix raced to her. "We ride." "Oh, no, you're not getting me on that thing." "It's the only way." "You know I hate these things." It was more of a plea than a statement of fact. "Hop on." Alora held out her hand for me to take. I hopped on. Lennox walked slowly, picking his steps carefully. I looked behind and saw several hopefuls waist deep in the snow. Apparently the field we started in contained snow pits. Now I understand why we had to ride. Lemix sensed where the pits were and avoided them. Unfortunately, we weren't the only ones on Dignitz. I noticed several others nearby. We arrived at a massive cave entrance. I like caves about as much as I like Dignitz, so knowing my luck, we have to go in there. "We have to go in there," Alora said. "Of course we do." We dismounted Lemix and went on foot, since Dignitz hate caves as much as I do. "We're looking for a tunnel that looks like it goes straight down," Alora said. "So if it doesn't go straight down, where does it go?" "To the finish line." "Well, after we swim for a bit. But my navigation pod shows it's the fastest way." She must have seen the panic on my face. "Don't worry, I'm an excellent swimmer." It didn't take long to find the dreaded hole. The other hopefuls had already taken one look and moved on, which, now that I think about it, is a brilliant idea. "You know, navigation pods can be wrong," I said. "We jump." Alora walked to the edge. A blast of cold air came from the abyss. "Let's throw a stone in and see if we can hear it hit the bottom before casting ourselves into certain death." "On the count of three," Alora ignored me. "Now listen to me. I'm the captain, and the captain gets to decide when." Alora grabbed my hand and yanked me into the darkness. We didn't fall long before hitting water. The icy cold took my breath away. It's a good thing Alora can swim, because I was in shock, unable to move. She grabbed me and swam faster than humanly possible, which makes sense since she's an android. We made it outside the cave and saw Bob and several priests cheering and bowing at our arrival. We were the first to finish. Yay me. We made it back to the temple the same way we left. The elite guard never knew we were gone. Alora and I had a moment on that mountain. I might be the captain, but she's the one in charge. I'm sure I only got the promotion because the company doesn't allow androids to advance the corporate ladder. I'm not fit to lead. Laura has been trying to get me to see that we must win this tournament to get the Delanium, but I'm afraid of the unknown. I want certainty, not risk. In short, I'm no leader. The truth hit me like a ton of bricks, and just like being hit with a ton of bricks, it hurt. I really thought I was in charge, but it was only an illusion. Well, I might know the truth, but there's no way in the world I'm going to let Alora know that I know. General Logs of Explopod 3526 by Charlie Fervor. Day 34 of the General Exploratory Mission. I think it is day 34 at least. Carrie said, I blacked out for a while there and nobody is really sure how long it has been since Command checked with us. There have been 34 sunsets, but we all read the mission logs from previous missions and know that the days are longer here than at home. The safety pod has kept us from exposure, and there have been no further deaths. Wildlife has started to appear around us now that the safety pod stopped smoking. Our mission biologist, Lucas, says they do not look like anything from home. The oxygen levels of this planet are a little higher than home's oxygen levels. Command said it was likely that we would feel the difference in an excess of energy, not a lack of it. I do not know if they read many previous reports, like we all did. Previous reports claim the opposite, that the oxygen overwhelmed what was actually needed. Since this is a general exploratory mission, I am not concerning the crew with this. The safety pod balances the chemicals we all need for survival and keeps wildlife from gnawing on anyone. Once we all feel secure in our bodies again after a long journey, then I will move to find a way to communicate to command. It is unusual that things have been so silent from them. On previous missions, I have scarcely gone a single day without hearing from them. Well, I am being requested to stop typing and help make food. Our quarters are so tight here that we cannot multitask as efficiently as we could normally. At home, I would offer a hand as I continued typing, but we do not have the space for that here. Command squeezed the safety pods to an efficiency level that no one else could achieve. I will check back sooner than 34 days. In health and heart, Julius. Transcript from Explopod 3526, Mission Terra, Day 78, Terra Day 39. Officer, the animals. Yes, I am aware that they are getting closer. Do we have a plan to handle them? Handle them? Carrie, we have to study them, not hurt them. Lucas, respectfully, they are going to hurt us if we do not handle them. We cannot. Command will have our necks if we affect this planet any more than we already have. Command probably was aware that this was possible, Lucas. There is a banging sound, and then the recording is cut off. Today is day 45 of General Exploratory Mission. Lucas is becoming paranoid that either me or Carrie are going to cause harm to the living beings of this planet and has started patrolling the pod. He could be gathering valuable data for our home, but it has never been in my character to push my crew beyond where they want to settle naturally. Carrie, on the other hand, has become paranoid of command. This confuses me, but I cannot fault her for it either. The oxygen levels have become difficult to compensate for, even within the safety pod. Carbon dioxide levels of this planet have risen since the last exploratory mission here, but it is still much lower than home. I can feel the subtle shifts inside my body as more oxygen enters it. Blood is starting to heat, carry warmth where there was none. It could be my imagination, but I think one of my hearts is beating faster too. That could be fear as well. I am not sure. Electric pulses are hard to measure without specific equipment, and the safety pod has none of it. Lucas is yelling about wanting to leave to explore the place where we landed. I am certain that this is a death sentence. None of us have command over one another. Officer is merely a title, no power held within it. If he does leave, then I will have to report to command, although I would have to leave to do that as well. Is one wrong to right, another wrong acceptable? I am beginning to question my own morality against that of commands. They never should have sent anyone here in the first place, a planet so different from ours. It has always been a death sentence, has it not? Carrie and Lucas are screaming at one another, so I must pause my entry here. By the time I type here again, I hope I have contacted command and gotten an answer. Let us hope that nobody dies in the meantime. In health and heart, Julius. Transcript from Explopod 3526, Day 100, Terra Day 50. Julius, there is nothing you could have... Carrie, do you hear yourself? That was our friend, Lucas. He was the only one who could... He is not, though. He was far from the only pick for this mission. He was just available. Available? Seriously? Yes, I am serious. Do you want to try to contact command? Or? Contacting command will only put one of us in danger of what happened to Lucas. Yes. What do you expect to do if we only have one of us to pilot the pod back home? This was not a craft designed for solo piloting. I do not know. The recording ends after 30 seconds of silence to preserve battery of the recording device. Mission Day 60. I have fully lost control of my remaining partner in this mission. Lucas tried to go study the animals studying our craft. He was massacred by animals with too many teeth. He was torn limb from limb, and we could not even hear him scream. The roots left by him in our craft withered a day later, clearly aware that their connection to life had died. Carrie, meanwhile, has decided that this means command sent us here to die. The safety pod is only piloted by two or more beings. If one of us lives, then we could not fly home in distress. That remaining being would stay here to die as our fellows did. I do not think Carrie means to kill me, but I am also unsure if she means to work together to get us home. So far, it seems far more likely that we both die here. The animals that killed Lucas have not left the safety pod alone. They have space black noses and eyes which reflect back at us like crude mirrors. We are unsure how they perceive us. Lucas was the biologist. Carrie is here for the pod, and I am, well, I'm not sure why command hired me. My job at home is a journalist. At best, I'm here to document what happens now, if anything. Command sent me here to die for the others to study. They did not count on Lucas being the more curious one. Maybe the next time I type here, be safely nestled at home. In health and heart, Julius. Transcript of Explopod 3526, Day 145, Terra Day 72. Command, do you read me? This is Carrie. Helio, requesting assistance on planet 205-18181. Command, do you read me? Static fills the audio, soft cursing in the background only covered by the extremely loud static. Command, this is Carrie Helio, safety pod mechanic of Exopod 3526, requesting assistance on planet 205-18181. Do you read me? Again, static fills the audio. Breathing cuts through the static. If this is going anywhere, I might as well say my piece. Julius Aram was killed 3 days ago by animals native to this planet. Lucas Scantia was killed 25 days ago by the same animals. Command was aware that these animals existed and that they caused harm to our people. Our bodies are not adaptable to this planet's atmosphere. It is... Soft breathing and hiccuping is heard before she continues. It is too oxygenated for our carbon dioxide-based bodies. There are similar life forms to us here, but they have clearly adapted to the oxygen levels native to this planet. We would require many thousands of years living and dying here before a mission here is anything but suicide. Beyond the simple fact that we are not designed for this planet, it also appears that the life forms comparable to us are commonly massacred in mass here. We are not safe. We will never be safe here. I have tapped into this planet's communication systems and searched for comparable images, and it appears again and again that the life forms known as plants do not receive the same respect as we deserve as we get back home. There is silence for 20 seconds before she continues, keeping the recording device operable. Carrie Helios requests immediate access. Assistance. On planet 205-18181, command, do you copy? Carrie Helio, pod mechanic of Explo Pod 3526, requests immediate assistance. Soft crying is heard until the recording device cuts off. The last evidence of ExploPod 3526. Borrowing Minutes from Oblivion by Deborah Landers. Synchronous existed in a unique curve in the fabric of the universe, the space between the end of one universe and the beginning of another. It was not the sort of place you wanted to go, but it also wasn't somewhere you ended up accidentally. No sane person really wanted to find the exact moment before the world is consumed by oblivion, but that was exactly what Synchronous was, and it had a thriving population living in the second before total destruction. It had started, Velis knew, as an attempt to fix everything, to reverse the destruction and set the world to right again so it could keep turning away until its next scheduled apocalyptic event. It hadn't even been the first of its kind, as history told them of Eden, of Babel, of Uruk, Bullion, Olympus, Hawaiki, Tripura, Rocabera, and Shangri-La. There had been other moments when the world hovered on the brink of destruction, and then something changed. In the space of a single moment stretched to infinity, something happened, and an ordinary place became extraordinary because it was where something new began. Some of the citizens of Synchronous believed in that assurance, that something would suddenly shift and provide them with answers if they waited long enough for it. Others began to doubt the probability of rescue and put more work into trying to figure out how to fix the world themselves. Still others were resigned to their fate and the inevitability of the world shattering apart around them. Velis had been born in Synchronous and still didn't know what she believed. Life had given her no answers, only the endless questions and the constant awareness of impending doom that filled the atmosphere like the smell of smoke in the distance. She took every moment she could get from the slow creep of nothingness, all too aware that her very existence was unnatural and fleeting. Running did nothing, but the act of moving in a world trapped in a single moment settled something inside her enough that she could breathe. Becoming a messenger seemed only natural to the grand scheme of things. "Did you hear what the clockers are saying?" her boss asked as she shuffled the packages she was supposed to deliver into her satchel. "They're saying they might have figured it out." "They always say that, Quinn," Velis muttered. "What makes this time different from the last 1,000 times?" "This time they said the clock started moving again." Velis froze. "The clock? The countdown? Yep. And they think that's a good thing? Well, if the clock's moving, it means everything else is too, right? Quinn, Bella said, carefully laying her hands flat on the counter so she didn't hit something or launch herself at his face. The clock is just a countdown to the end. If it hits zero, there is nothing else. Quinn scoffed. You don't remember what it was like before. It's not an end. It's just what's next. Well, next has nothing to do with any of us, because we aren't going to be there to see it. She swept the last of the packages into her bag, swung it over her shoulder, and left before the conversation could turn into a full-blown argument. Quinn liked to lord it over everyone that he remembered when the world was still turning and time still ticking. He'd been living in Synchronous before it was called Synchronous, and acted like that was so much better than people like Valais, whose life was simultaneously microseconds and decades long. Don't listen to Quinn. He's an idiot. Valais turned to look over at her fellow messenger, Tay, who had his bag hanging empty over his shoulder as he returned from his route. I know. Yeah, but it's more than that, Tay said, leaning against the wall. The clockers say the clock is moving, but I just looked at it. It ticks forward 1 second, then back. That's not moving. That's just a loop, as if we weren't already in one of those. This isn't a loop. Most of us wouldn't exist if this was a loop. Tay shrugged. Call it whatever you want. The effect is the same. We're going nowhere fast. You say that like we have anywhere to go, Valais muttered bitterly. We live and die at the end of the world, and that's it. Not if the Tracers have something to say about it. If you've been listening to the Tracers, it's no wonder you think it's a loop. They do whatever they can not to focus on the here and now, as though they don't exist here at all. Tay scoffed, turning away. Come talk to me when you're actually willing to listen about the future. At least I believe there can be one. That may work for you, but I was never very good at blind faith. Valais started towards the clock tower at the center of Synchronous. Mounted at the very top of it was the clock. But the clockers who worked on the upper floors had decided to build up around it so no one would see whether it was working or not. She remembered being young and watching those walls go up, feeling both scared and relieved not to see the countdown anymore. It wasn't moving then, and she wouldn't have been able to do anything if it had been. But having that decision taken out of her hands was the kindest thing any clocker had ever done for her. Of course, when the other response she tended to get was, "Get out of here so I can continue my work," it wasn't as big of an achievement as it seemed. Clockers, Tracers, and Sloths all had different ways of dealing with Synchronous and everything it represented. The clockers were actively trying to fix the world as it was. They tended to be older guard, the ones who remembered what everything was like before and were therefore desperate to get it back. The Tracers had only known Synchronous as it was, and they were trying to track down whatever thread of time would lead them into something better. Whether that was back in time to the world the clockers remembered or forward into whatever world came after. Sloths, on the other hand, did not care. The clock was a countdown timer that they were waiting to finish, and they had already decided they weren't going to do anything about it. They thrived on the fact that nothing truly changed all that much, and money meant next to nothing in the face of destruction. They mocked the effort of those who tried to achieve something normal and lamented about the fact that nothing had happened yet. Valais did not consider herself a sloth, nor was she a clocker or a tracer. In her own mind, she was a spark. Not a big or important one. Just a tiny bit of fire that escaped containment just to burn out for lack of fuel. She knew what the end would be, but she was still trying for something, and she couldn't even say what that was. Like a ghost, she drifted through the clock tower, dropping off packages at the same doors she normally delivered to, winding her way up to the higher levels where she could see the clock for herself. Tay was right. It did look like the clock was looping, but contrary to what Quinn had implied, she didn't think that was a good thing. The clockers who normally worked on that level were acting like the clock didn't actually exist, doing whatever they needed to avoid looking at it. She even watched one of them shield their eyes from it so they didn't have to see the way it glitched over and over again. For the first time, Vale has considered that this might actually be the end of the line for Synchronous, that everyone might have failed in what they were trying to do and succeeded only in setting themselves that much closer to destruction. The weight of the realization settled on her shoulders like getting caught beneath the drainage slope when the wastewater was released. She was just a spark, just as doomed as she'd always felt, stuck staring at the end she had no hope of changing. But instead of helpless, the feeling made her angry. She had lived her whole life in Synchronous, and between the tracers, the clockers, and the sloths doing whatever they wanted, she was going to die in it too at this rate. What was worse, she was going to die having done nothing in the grand scheme of things. She had survived, and that was all that could be said of her. Her bag was empty, but no one stopped her as she made her way down the catwalk to the actual mechanism of the clock, her steps in time with the tick-click, tick-click of glitching time. All it did was reinforce how insignificant she was to them, how her only use was in how she let herself be used. Vailis looked around at the clockers desperately focusing on their self-assigned tasks to the point of ignorance of anything around them. There were equations, half erased, squalled across many surfaces as they could reach. There were some clockers having quiet or loud debates about ideas she would never be able to fully understand. There were tools sitting abandoned on a table beside the clock mechanism that rattled gently with each tick-click. She stole the heaviest gear wrench she found. For how shrouded in secrecy it was, the clock was not at all difficult to access. The mechanism was larger and more impressive than she'd been expecting as gears and chains moved around her. Inside, it didn't follow the tick-click hearing on the outside. It was a constant grind and release instead, with metal sliding against metal until the weight behind the motion backed off. But unlike what she had been expecting, it was not some mystical thing. It was ordinary and it was broken, and she hated how much of her life had been wasted in fear of this machine. Supposedly, there was something in this clock that halted time, keeping them hovering on the edge of oblivion long enough to make the impossible manifest in their favor. But she couldn't see anything strange or unusual about it. Vailis wandered down to where the grinding was loudest and found a set of gears driven by weight. But as the weight swung, the chains holding it attempted to advance the gear, only to grind to a halt as they got caught in the teeth. She watched it happen several more times, the same way each time, before she decided to do something about it. The weights needed to be dealt with first before she'd be able to shift the chain, so she climbed down the ladder to the platform below to see if she could detach them. Fortunately enough, there was a catch mechanism for holding the weights while giving slack to the chain above, and activating it was as easy as pulling a lever. The grinding stopped immediately. Knowing she only had a few moments before someone wondered about the moving clock that had suddenly stopped again, Vailis climbed back up to the mechanism that had been catching and pulled up enough chain to try and untangle it. She dropped it a couple of times trying to fix it, but eventually managed to thread the chain back into place enough that it wouldn't catch in the same way again. As she released the weights, A steady, metallic clicking sound filled the space, echoing against the walls. It was louder when she was standing over the gears and chains she had untangled, shifting constantly forward. The clockers had wanted the clock to move. The tracers wanted a future. The sloths didn't want to work for whatever came next. Vailers picked up the gear wrench, debating with herself whether or not to follow through on the idle thought of smashing the clock that had led her to examine it. She set it back down and made her way out of the mechanism, past all of the clockers still ignoring the tick, tick, tick of their favorite obsession. They either didn't notice the difference, or they were ignoring it even harder to avoid thinking about what came next. Before she left the upper levels, Vailers turned back to look at the clock. At least a minute had passed, so she knew she would be able to see proof of her effort. Vailers had considered herself a spark, doomed to burn out. She had forgotten that sparks did not always fizzle. The clock, the countdown that had ruled her entire existence with the looming promise of oblivion, was moving in reverse. Time was the only thing they had been certain of before, hanging eternally frozen as all of Synchronus tried to fight fate while searching for miracles. Halting the clock was the only miracle they'd found, and now she'd set it running again, running in reverse. Vailers had forgotten that sometimes sparks became a flame. For something a little less moody, The Time-Traveling Lawnmower and the Dangers of eBay by Emma Tiffin. Dear Mom and Dad, don't worry, I'm not writing to tell you I flunked philosophy. We're way past that. I'm dropping out. I'm not just dropping out of school, I'm dropping out of life. This world has gotten too much for me. Every time I read the news, my anxiety flares up, and I can't handle it anymore. I'm going to a better place. Don't worry about me. I'll be fine. It's all of you I'm leaving behind I feel sorry for. This isn't your fault. You both have been the best parents. The fault lies in the times we live in, so I'm going to a different one. Love, Jackie. February 8, 2026. In retrospect, I realize that the wording of my letter to my parents was poorly crafted. I was trying to be melodramatic and pained artist, but missed the very understandable alternative I accidentally alluded to. I wasn't planning to die, just the opposite, in fact. It was my great fear of death that started the whole caper. I'll start at the beginning with Teddy and the eBay ad. January 12, 2026. The first I heard of the time machine was from my friend Teddy, former housemate and history nerd. We had to part ways domestically due to differences in hygiene standards, but the guy is cool, and we've stayed friends. Teddy has two hobbies: readying through the entire history section of the university library and scouring eBay at unearthly hours of the morning. For what exactly, few have ever known, but eBay is where Teddy found the time machine. It took us a while to decide that the time machine listed was legitimate, us being Teddy, myself, and our friend Pepper. Pepper is a peripatetic sociology major with an unnerving sense of adventure and even more unnerving mood swings. But she has a car, so we've stuck together. Most of our meetups after Teddy saw the time machine were spent discussing said time machine. Was it real? Was it a good price as far as time machines go? Was the guy selling it a serial killer? And why did it look like a lawnmower? Over time, its presence in our conversation waned, but Teddy's enthusiasm for it never did. The thought of going back to a better time in history was tempting for all of us. January 25, 2026. Pepper, Teddy, and I had long run out of money for therapy, so we did do-it-yourself counseling on each other, which never made anything better. If you want to save yourself from drowning, you actually need someone who knows how to swim. I mean, every morning you wake up to some new world-ending event on the news, drawled Teddy from the back seat, staring at the waves beyond the beach. Then don't read it, mumbled Pepper, her mouth half full of Chinese takeout, which she had already spilled prodigiously all over the steering wheel. I lolled my head into my hand and watched the setting sun sink behind the ocean. But you can't not read it. We have to be informed citizens. This evolving catastrophe in history in the making. Someday students just like us will have classes, even degrees, on the 2020s and be learning about our times, returned Teddy. If there's still a world by then, Pepper sighed nonchalantly. My stomach churned a little. The end of the world felt like an all too real possibility right now. Guys, can we just focus on the positives, maybe? I suggested, drawing lines through the condensation on my Diet Coke. Like what? Said Pepper, rolling her eyes to me. They were so blue and her hair was so pale, I didn't have a ready answer. I read an article this morning from the University of New Mexico about microplastics in the brain. The average person inhales 74,000 microplastic particles a day. I mean, this stuff is in the air, not just in our plastic bags and clothing. And they're finding, like, that it messes with the brain's immune cells. The plastic is altering our brain chemistry in ways we don't understand yet, Teddy steamrolled, his soggy white takeout box sitting forgotten on his khaki slacks. I mean, they could be killing all of us and we don't realize it yet. Yeah, chimed Pepper, digging aggressively into her chow mein with the cheap wooden chopsticks. And if the microplastics don't get you, all the toxic nonstick cookware will. Or the flame retardant on fabric furniture, parabens in your shampoo, aerosols from cleaning products, or a new disease epidemic, long-term effects of medications, nuclear war, civil war, economic collapse, fentanyl, mass shootings, plane crashes, electric blackouts, extreme weather phenomena, all the chemicals in ultra-processed foods, contaminated drinking water, glyphosate, red meat, the keto diet, raising cancer rates and inexplicable heart attacks in the young. Aspartame. Teddy's face was suddenly next to mine, and his buggy eyes, magnified by his hockey puck glasses, were looking intently at my Diet Coke. Okay, stop. Just stop, I yelled. Pepper and Teddy stared at me. I looked back at them. Teddy, is that time machine still for sale? February 5, 2026. That conversation in the van was the final anxious straw, and consequently how we found ourselves on a sunny Wednesday, sitting around in some random garage. The time machine was sitting in the middle of our strange circle. Pepper was perched on an oil drum, and Teddy sat musingly in a pile of cardboard boxes, his fingertips pressed together in front of his mile-thick glasses. Opposite me sat Alan, the owner of the time machine, dressed inauspiciously in cargo shorts and a polo. His white sock and sandal-clad feet were kicked up on a case of bottled water. It had been silent for a long time. So let me get this straight, resumed Teddy, tapping his fingers together. The time machine has two settings. Correct, assented Alan. He seemed normal enough with a normal voice, a normal house, and a head of white hair that would normally belong to a 78-year-old. The first allows the time travelers to choose the point in history to which they want to return. Teddy paused. And the second automatically sends the time traveler to the best time in history to be alive, finished Alan, nodding slowly. Our eyes never left the object in the center of the circle. "I don't know, folks. I think this old guy's taking us for a ride," said Pepper flatly. "I mean, it's a lawnmower." She wasn't wrong. The time machine among us was indeed an old lawnmower, or looked very much like one. Alan, however, was unperturbed. "Well, let's give it a try, then," he said cheerfully, lurching forward from his lawn chair. "I'll get her started. By the time you kids have decided on a time destination, it'll be warmed up and ready to go." He pulled on the cord several times, and the lawnmower sputtered to life. "Been a while since I used her," said Alan as it settled into a low hum, and he plopped down again. "Okay, it's time to get down to business," I said resolutely. "Where and when are we going?" "I've got an idea," blurted out Pepper before Teddy could grace us with his historical wisdom. "The medieval times. I've always wanted to do the whole castle and jousting thing." "No," said Teddy, pushing up his glasses. "Too much war and disgusting hygiene standards. Castles would have been cold and drafty anyways, as well as noisy and crowded. The food would have been bland, especially if you were a peasant. Who knows who we would be when we arrived? We wouldn't be nobility, ergo, and we'd be subsistence farmers with no rights and maybe even enslaved, and we would be even worse for women." "Okay, so no castles," sighed Pepper. "I think about the 50s a lot. It just seems like a nice time to be alive. There wasn't any internet, and people seemed to really connect with each other and care. Food was real, and education standards were higher," I said. Teddy all but laughed. "It might be nice for you as a middle-class white woman. Wouldn't be so nice for me," he scoffed. My face flushed a little at my ignorance. I had been friends with Teddy for so long, I sometimes forgot that he was African-American. "Besides, it would depend on where you lived. For example, let's say we picked 1955. If we showed up in Los Angeles, it would be great, and we could go to Disneyland the day it opened. If we showed up in Sudan, we'd be in the middle of a civil war. If we arrived in Argentina, we'd find ourselves in the middle of a coup. But if we turned up in Austria, we'd be celebrating the end of military operation and the formation of a sovereign state." "Don't forget the lead paint," chimed Pepper. "Wait, Alan, can we decide where we go with the time machine or just the year?" I asked. "It's a time machine, not a teleportation device," Alan replied. "So we just end up exactly where we are right now, but in a different time," mused Pepper. "More or less," Alan yawned. "More or less," said Teddy incredulously. "What do you mean?" "Look, it's an old time machine, and I may have missed some recall notices. At times there are glitches, and then you could end up anywhere in the world. But don't worry, the time will be accurate. It's the geographic features that can go haywire." "I don't believe this," groaned Pepper, rubbing her face. "We have to be very careful deciding which year to go to. It has to be stable everywhere in the world, just in case we end up somewhere we didn't intend to go," said Teddy gravely. "What about 1900, I suggested. I didn't want to admit my deep and pervasive love for Downton Abbey lead to much daydreaming on my part of living in the early 20th century. "We still wouldn't be able to vote, Jackie," said Pepper from the oil drum. "Plus, if we're going to live the rest of our lives from that time on, both world wars would be coming, and the influenza epidemic," replied Teddy. "There's the Anglo-Boer War going on in South Africa, civil unrest in China, and a bubonic plague outbreak in San Francisco. Not the most stable year." "I want to be a pirate," cried Pepper, banging on the drum. "Teddy, when were the pirates afloat?" "Well, pirates have been around for much of history," I said, "but you're probably thinking of pirates around the time of the 16th and 17th centuries. Imagine, guys, the three of us aboard one of those ships, the smell of the sea, swinging from the rigging, the occasional cannon blast. I could get a parrot and maybe even a peg leg." Pepper was fully engrossed in her dream when Teddy cut her short impatiently. Pepper, this is history we're talking about, real history, not the Pirates of the Caribbean. The 1500s were some of the most tumultuous times in history. War, slavery, and above all, the Black Death. Wait, I said excitedly, a new idea germinating in my mind. All the bad stuff in history, most of it is caused by people. What if we went to a time before people? Like the Jurassic period? Asked Pepper. Teddy cocked his head. Not a bad idea. There'd be dinosaurs. I'm in, said Pepper definitively. But the climax of the middle Jurassic period would be much warmer, and the carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere would be 7 to 10 times higher than it is now, not to mention the obvious danger getting eaten by a dinosaur, Teddy said. That's true, and now that I think about it, there wouldn't be any pre-existing infrastructure. We'd be starting from scratch, and we don't have the knowledge to know how to survive in that virgin environment, I conceded. Yes, that's exactly the problem with my idea. I think one of the best times to be alive would be when humans were still hunter-gatherers, before the development of agriculture, said Teddy. But we're suburbanites. We don't know how to live off the land. And life would have been uncertain and hard. We'd be exposed to every element and predator with no modern weapons or medicine. We'd be completely at the mercy of the earth. We fell silent, beginning to doubt our great plan to escape the evils of our times by going to a different one. It seemed no matter where you went, evil would always be there waiting for you. As we sat contemplating time and space and the existence of evil, the time machine abruptly stopped. A light on the top lit up and began to spin slowly. Alan uncrossed his legs and stood up with a telltale whelp and a slap on his knees. "Where are you going?" I asked. "What's going on with the machine?" "I'm sorry, kids, but you took too long deciding. It's gone into setting 2, autopilot." "Wait," said Teddy, and looks of horror spread onto each of our faces, though doubts remained about the time-traveling lawnmower, even the remotest chance of getting spat out into a random time, no matter how perfect, was terrifying. "Alan," screamed Pepper, "how could you not have told us this sooner?" Teddy was on his feet, holding his head in his hands, spinning this way and that in a crazed pacing. "No, no, no," he mumbled. "It's impossible. There's no time in history that would be perfect for all three of us." I pleaded with Alan to turn it off, but he had his hand on the door of the garage. "I'm sorry, Jackie. I can't turn it off. The glitches." "Stupid glitches," I gritted out, clenching my fists. "How did this all happen?" Alan looked me straight in the face. "You spent too much time thinking about how you might die, and not enough time thinking about how you might live." He winked at me, then stepped through the door and shut it behind him. Panic saturated the garage, and the three of us ricocheted around the room like pinballs until the light on the infernal lawnmower slowed and came to a stop. We stood around it, hardly daring to breathe, wondering what our new reality would be. "Did it work?" Pepper whispered. "Dunno, shh," Teddy whispered back, holding up his hand in response to a rustling outside the garage door. "Holy socks, it's a dinosaur," whimpered Pepper. Teddy motioned furiously at her to stay quiet. "Pepper, it's not a dinosaur. We're still in a garage. We couldn't have gone that far back in time," he whispered. "So it's true," I said, half dazed. "The peak time of all humanity was actually the 90s. "What?" asked Teddy. Before I could explain, the garage door groaned and scraped as it raised slowly, and the sunlight streamed inside temporarily, blinding us. I think some of us, maybe all of us, screamed, but the only sound we heard in return was laughing. Alan, laughing. "You kids are really something," he chuckled as he shoveled back into the garage. "Alan?" asked Teddy, scrutinizing him. "Yes. You don't look any younger." "That's because I'm not." "We didn't go anywhere?" asked Pepper. "No." "Well, if the present day really is the perfect time to be alive, then the cosmic lawnmower might have actually worked. There's just no way of knowing." Our faces didn't need words to communicate to Teddy what we thought of the time machine. "Alan?" I asked, turning around. "Yeah?" You said it's been a while since you used the time machine. Uh-huh. So it's real, or? All I got was one of his enigmatic winks. I shrugged and walked on before turning around again. What's the life for on the lawnmower? For when I mow at night, obviously. Crackpot, said Pepper under her breath. February 6, 2026. Dear Mom and Dad, did you get my last letter? If you did, sorry for my poor choice of words. Everything's great here. If you didn't, burn it. Love, Jackie. I'm sorry. What just happened? I asked angrily, beginning to be annoyed that we had, in all probability, just been conned by Alan from eBay. I could tell from Pepper and Teddy's faces that I wasn't alone. Alan could read it there himself. He took off his glasses and rubbed his eyes, then spent a good deal of time observing the pavement. The perfect time to be alive is elusive, he started slowly. But any time can be good if you have the courage to see it. The solution to your problem, kids, isn't time travel. Because the real problem you're trying to escape is far deeper than time. It's beyond time, and so is the solution. With those enigmatic words, he shuffled back into the gloom of the garage. Pepper snorted. Some solution, Alan. Alan came shuffling back. He held two books in his hands. Read this. It might surprise you, he said, holding out a thick leather-bound book. A Bible? Laughed Teddy. You're kidding, right? Alan held out the second book. If you won't read that, then give Robinson Crusoe a try. The three of us trudged back to Pepper's van. No one can ever know about this, I said solemnly. Agreed, said Teddy. I think Alan is a bit of a crackpot, grumbled Pepper. A bit? I said sarcastically. Strangely, though, I felt relieved that we had been fooled. Somehow didn't want to be anywhere else but here and now. I guess we still don't know if the time machine is real or not, said Teddy. Seriously, Teddy? I sighed.